Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Baseball America Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Peter Flaherty, as always on these draft shows. Today is September 14th. It started to cool down a little bit in my neck of the woods, Peter. Looks like fall is certainly coming or here. How are you doing, man? How's the weather up there in Boston or in Massachusetts, I guess I should say?
Everything's doing great. The weather, honestly, it might be a little bit of a hot take. I'm a huge summer guy. But the last week, it's been incredibly and oppressively humid. So I'm excited for whenever the cold front moves through for it to cool down and for it to actually feel like fall. But I think that'll come tomorrow.
Yeah, today for us in Northern Virginia is like the first day it's been like 65 in the morning. And I didn't really notice that humidity, which is typically more common down here in this area of the country. I'm surprised to hear about the humidity up there. Do you guys get humidity consistently, or has it just been kind of an unusual stretch of that for you? Because I typically think of like North Carolina, Georgia, Florida for humidity, not Massachusetts.
In the summer a little bit, but nothing too oppressive or tropical. Like the last week, it's been gross to go outside. So it'll be a welcome change for it to actually start to feel like fall a little bit.
Yeah. I think I've definitely grown more on the fall weather as I've gotten older. My wife is also a huge summer fan, so she's going to be ticked when it starts to cool down. But, you know, I welcome it. We get postseason baseball. We get hoodie weather, which is always fun. But enough about the weather. Let's move on to the National League East draft reviews. Last week's episode, we finished up our American League draft reviews with the AL West. This week, we are starting with the NL East, maybe timely. The Braves just locked up their sixth division title in 6 years, which is pretty impressive. I was kind of lamenting the fact that it's so unfair in baseball that someone like Ronald Acuña Jr. has never done anything but win his division. And then we have Mike Trout, who in 13 or 14 seasons in the big leagues has only won the division a single time. But that's baseball, I suppose. I guess let's get right into these reviews. We'll start with the Braves since they're at the top of the division. We'll go Braves, Phillies, Marlins, Mets, Nationals for this week's episode. And we'll just get right in it. I think all these teams have some fun players to talk through, some interesting draft strategies. And like all the divisions, it's kind of nice doing this division by division breakdown because everyone is picking in a different part of the draft, which just keeps things interesting. I feel like it'd be a little bit more boring if we went straight down the board. But enough digression from me. First round pick for the Braves was Hurston Waldrop, a right-handed pitcher out of Florida, 24 overall. In the second round, the Braves took Virginia Tech right-handed pitcher Drew Hackenberg. In the second supplemental round, or I should say a comp pick after the second round, they took Campbell right-handed pitcher Cade Keeler. In the third round, the team took Oregon shortstop Savin Ceballos. In the fourth round, Florida high school right-hander Garrett Bauman. In the fifth round, Georgia high school outfielder Isaiah Drake. So that's how the Braves kind of went on the draft theme that I put on the team this year was flamethrowers, just a ton of pitchers that get into the upper 90s with their fastballs. I believe eight of the pitchers that the team took inside the top 10 rounds have at least touched 96 miles per hour. Now, maybe it's a little bit more common for all pitchers who are drafted to be touching those velocities, but the Braves are certainly a team that has not shied away from hard-throwing pitchers and gotten a lot out of them in recent years, and they took a good collection of those pitchers in this year's draft, highlighted by Hurston Waldrop, who I know we've talked about a lot on this podcast throughout the spring, just some of the best pure stuff in the class. But what did you think about this draft, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I think that pitching was the theme here for Atlanta. They went out and got arguably it's tough to compare him to Skeens, but I think that in terms of arm talent and upside, Waldrop is right there with Skeens in terms of what he can do in a major league rotation, especially in Atlanta. You touched on it, but I mean, there's an argument to be made. He's got 4+ pitches with his fastball. Both his slider and curveball are borderline double pluses, especially the slider. And then I think that the split change is also double plus. He really kills spin, and it really just falls off the table as it approaches the plate. He's got an athletic delivery, super quick arm. And I mean, they've been pretty aggressive with moving through the system early, and the early returns have been excellent, and he's shown he can handle it through 21 innings, 31 Ks to 12 walks. In his first couple of starts in Mississippi in Double A, control's been a little bit of an issue with 6 walks and 6 innings, but still getting strikeouts. And it's important to keep in mind this is after he threw 102 innings this spring at Florida, so might be a little tired. But I think that Waldrop is someone who can be an impact arm in that rotation as soon as next year, honestly. And like so many of these guys with the Braves, I think he's got. And it's a bold statement. I think he has Cy Young type upside in him, and just sheer arm talent. I'd put him right there with Skeens overall. Yeah. And then with Hackenberg, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to mention the Braves just being really aggressive with their pitchers. I mean, they've kind of developed a reputation for pushing players quickly through the system. Michael Harris, Spencer Strider, AJ Smith-Shawver. All recent names who really just flew through the system. I think Waldrop has the sort of stuff to be able to do that, especially depending on what role they want to use him in. I definitely think he is a starter, and the Braves are obviously going to develop him as a starter, but he's got the stuff that would really play in a bullpen role if they find like they need that as they're competing. I don't know why he couldn't at least start in the bullpen and then work into a starting role down the line, just depending on what the team actually needs. The Braves are also one of the more aggressive teams in assigning pitchers post-draft and really having them get into pro ball and log a lot of innings. They have 6 players who have thrown 14 or more innings this year in pro ball. They're mostly the college guys, Corey Wall, Riley Goins, Mitch Ferris, Riley Frey, Hurston Waldrop, and then Lucas Braun. I just want to mention him really quick. 6th-round pick. He's already up to 27 innings, and they're pretty tremendous. It was 32 strikeouts, 5 walks, 22 hits allowed on a 2.67 ERA. So they're not afraid of getting these guys in the system and letting them continue to throw. So it's definitely pitcher heavy. It's a lot of stuff, and we're already seeing a lot of these guys in action, which is not super common, I would say, with this later draft date. There are a lot of teams that just shut most of their guys down, don't really have them get activated again, and certainly not a lot of teams that are throwing these sort of double-digit innings totals for college pitchers.
Right, exactly. I like how they get him going, get him used to what a potentially super heavy workload is going to look like, and to kind of have them keep throwing as opposed to shutting down. But moving on to Kuehler, I think that, or Hackenberg rather, I think that while there was some reliever risk with Waldrop, they're going to let him start for as long as he can physically handle it, or as long as he's effective, because they're not going to. I mean, no one's going to pick a reliever and give a reliever $3 million, 24th overall. So
yeah.
I think that they envision him as someone who can potentially be a front end of the rotation starter sooner rather than later. But with Hackenberg, he was another guy that I knew would go reasonably early, maybe in the 3rd or 4th round. I didn't totally expect to see him picked on day one. He's a sinker slider guy. Bowling ball sinker was 93-96. Slider is an above average pitch, was Virginia Tech's workhorse for the 2 years that he was there. Above average, I'd say, command and control of each of his offerings. And there isn't the upside and excitement that there is with Waldrop, I guess, around the pure stuff. But he can really pitch. He's durable. He's a high mileage arm. I'd say it's 3rd or 4th starter upside, realistically 4th starter upside. And again, you mentioned getting these guys in their system and moving them. He was excellent in Augusta and single A Augusta. And then they promoted him to Double A Mississippi, where he's just started. So, again, they're moving him quick. And then with Kuehler, I think that there might be the most reliever risk of the three here with Kuehler. But again, they took him at the very, very end of day one. He was outstanding at Campbell. The fastball's got excellent shape. He's got short arm action. The slider kind of, it almost looks and acts like a cutter at times. But I mean, it's up to 98, 99 with outstanding shape, and it'll kind of mix in a cutter and a changeup eventually. So yeah. I think that he's got the most reliever risk of the three. But again, when you look at just the sheer upside, he's got some of the most in the draft of any arm. It's just going to be a matter of refining the secondary stuff and making sure you can start.
Yeah, he definitely has been more of a below average strike thrower in the past, sprays the ball a little bit. I know people have critiqued the delivery in the past as well, but the stuff is really loud. You mentioned the fastball shape. It had some of the best ride in this class, I think. And I really liked the adjustments he made to that slider this spring. It seemed like he shortened up the shape of the pitch, went from a slider that had a little bit of sweeping action to more of like a gyro slider that, at least last spring with Campbell, he did throw that pitch better or more consistently for strikes. And I think pairing that fastball shape with his riding fastball is a good combination. And if he's able to throw a shorter breaking slider for a strike more often, I think that only helps him and can help his stuff play up. What I also think is fascinating with these first few picks for the Braves is the bonuses they were able to secure them for. I think the first two were a little surprising. I was surprised just in the first part that Hurston Waldrop even got to number 24 to the Braves. I really expected him to be off the board among the top 20 picks, especially considering that I viewed Waldrop as kind of the last player who was in that top tier of college arms. Once he was gone, I thought there was a pretty big drop off. So to see him get to 24 was surprising to me. And then seeing the bonus he signed for, it was $273,000 under slot at 24. So I think, like, while the draft was unfolding, this was one of my favorite picks of the draft, just pairing this sort of arm talent with a player development group that has done such a great job getting the most out of their arms. And then you add on that signing bonus, and I like it even more from the team's perspective. And then with Hackenberg, I really think his signing just goes to illustrate like how important leverage actually is in the draft. Like you said, I think I expected him to come off of the board in the third or fourth round range. He goes in the second, and he also signs over slot for almost $630,000. He's a draft eligible sophomore. I think that just highlights how important leverage can be. He had more of that kind of leverage. I can go back to school to play than a lot of these other college juniors who, if they do that, they're going to come back next year with next to no leverage. So that was just kind of interesting. The Braves were also one of the most aggressive teams this year when targeting senior signs at the back of day two. They were one of two teams who signed a player who they drafted for just $1,000. That was 10th rounder Pierre-Olivier Boucher. I probably butchered that name. I apologize. But they also had a couple players who signed for just $50,000. So I'm always interested in the financials. That helped them pay for overslots to Drew Hackenberg and the high schoolers they took in the fourth and fifth round with Garrett Bauman and Isaiah Drake, who are kind of toolsy, interesting, more projection types than the bulk of their draft class this year. So it's a really fascinating one.
Yeah, no, I agree. And Atlanta's another team, especially recently, where anyone that they pick is always going to kind of pique your interest a little bit in terms of how they'll develop them and their track record, obviously, of success with these homegrown guys. And then I think in the fourth round, the third rather, Sabin Ceballos was, it was his first year at the Division I level. He was outstanding at junior college powerhouse San Jacinto, but ended up hitting .333 for Oregon with 10 doubles, 18 home runs. He's a super, super physical kid. He's got I'd say plus raw power to all fields. It's very interesting. He's got a cannon of an arm, and was a converted catcher. He moved from catcher to third base. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not they want to maybe try him out behind the plate again, try and develop the catching, because he's got a plus throwing arm over third, and he's also got a plus throwing arm behind the plate. So a little bit of an interesting wrinkle there with Ceballos as to where they want to use him. But I think a pick on day two that stood out to me that they got.
I saw him super.
No, you can go ahead.
Yes. I was just saying, I saw him at the combine, and the raw power he showed there was extremely impressive. He is a massively physical player that helps his power, does not help him get out of the box or get moving on the field. He's a pretty slow runner. And so I am really intrigued with the kind of catcher conversion aspect of it, if he'll get any time. So far, he's only played third base and DH in pro ball. And it's weird because he was selected as a shortstop. Again, there have been a number of players who were selected as shortstops in this draft that I don't fully understand, because I don't think there's any scenario where he plays shortstop in pro ball. I'm not sure, again, that might be some sort of error, but weird that he's assigned as a shortstop for the draft.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at least with me. I was going to say, at least with me personally, he's not a shortstop. And I think that they're going to keep him over a third until there's a reason to move him, whether or not the defense kind of backs up or, you know, whatever, the body might back up a little more. But he's just, again, super physical. The raw power, I think, here is the carrying tool. It's power over hit, which in today's game, that's honestly most, if not every single player. So, one of the better college bats available at the time. That they went out and got. And then, like you mentioned, they targeted these older guys, these more experienced guys on day two, big time money savers. I think one that stood out to me was William and Mary, right-handed pitcher Corey Wall, that they got in the eighth. Spent most of his time in the bullpen for the Tribe, but 63 Ks across 52 innings pitched with only 11 walks. He's a, I think, a rare combination of a guy that is a strike thrower, but he's also got really good stuff. The fastball's up to, he'll pitch in the 2-4 range, touch a 5 and a 6. It's got good carry through the zone. The slider slash plus. The future is absolutely in the bullpen with Wall, but again, he's got pretty good pure stuff, and he's had a track record of throwing strikes. So a combination that I think bodes well, and someone that they might have, you know, hit on for super, super cheap on in late day two.
Yeah, one of the players that I liked on day two, kind of going in the opposite direction, they clearly saved some money and went over slot for Isaiah Drake, who's one of the hitters that stands out in just a pitcher heavy class. I think it's also, you look at the Braves system and they just don't have many bats to get you really excited. They traded away Justin Henry Molloy last offseason, who was one of the most exciting bats in the farm system. So adding a high upside, athletic, talented player like Drake and throwing him in the low minors and just kind of seeing what comes of him, I think is fascinating. Talking to scouts this spring, you heard about just the speed. He's a top of the scale runner. He has some tools. The approach was questioned at times, gets pull heavy at times. I think just developing a better understanding of what pitches to hit, what pitches to lay off of, was a common criticism for him. But he was also one of the most impressive players for me, again, at the combine in the workout scenario or setting, and then also in the high school game. Like, he really barreled the ball against pretty good live pitching in game, is young for the class. Has a chance to be an impact defender again. Needs to improve the routes he's taking in the outfield, reads and instincts. But I think he's just a fascinating, toolsy, and athletic projection play. Probably pretty large degree of variance with this pick, but I think it's the sort of talent that you want to see in a system that has been pretty thinned out over the past few years, and in the middle of a draft class that is much heavier on the pitching side. So that's a fun one, and maybe a name to keep in mind for Braves fans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think shifting focus to day three, obviously the theme I think here with Atlanta was pitching. So I think a guy that intrigues me a little bit in the 19th round is Riley Frye from Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Left-handed pitcher who was the Panthers' go-to starter this spring. Looking at the back of the baseball card, there aren't a ton of numbers that are going to jump out at you. It's not crazy loud strikeout numbers. It's not outstanding control, but he was excellent this summer in a brief stint on the Cape prior to the draft, used primarily out of the bullpen. Early returns have been pretty positive in terms of, again, just strike throwing at the affiliate level. 24 Ks to just 5 walks in 18 innings pitched with Augusta. And he'll sit really just 88 to 91, 92 with the fastball. He'll supplement it with a slider that flashes above average. It's really, I think, fifth starter type upside. But again, when you're looking for some of the late round guys that are going to hit, especially in Atlanta's draft, I think that Riley Frye was a guy that intrigued me the most.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that's all I have on the Braves. Any other players you want to mention before we move on to the Phillies?
No, I think we hit on it perfect.
Cool. All right, we will keep moving. Philly picked number 27 here at the back of the first round. Didn't have a second round pick, didn't have a fifth round pick. So they're one of the teams where we don't have as many players to talk through early in the draft. But They did take Aiden Miller, shortstop out of Florida High School. Again, another player selected as a shortstop. We had him as a third baseman. I think he is the third baseman. But an infielder selected out of Florida in the first round. In the third round, they took Hawaii infielder Devin Saltavon. In the fourth round, they took IMG Academy outfielder Tayshaun Walton. And I'll throw one more in here just so we get another player for the Phillies. Sixth rounder, they took Minnesota right-handed pitcher George Klassen. For the Phillies, I thought what stood out to them is a lot of the players they took early on were high school bats. They invested very heavily in high school hitters who did not have a lot of history, or at least had pretty big gaps in their high school history, whether that was from injuries, as was the case with Aiden Miller during the spring and Tayshaun Walton over the showcase circuit, or Devin Saltavon, who just seemed more of a late riser that I didn't have a lot of history on. Now, that's not to say that the Phillies didn't, but just not very, I guess, consensus players that you felt confident in their track records. Outside of maybe Miller, he was prominent enough that I think most people felt good about his hit power combination and just track record overall as a hitter. And then you look at the pitchers they took, it's a ton of power arms with big control questions, and I feel like George Klassen is just the perfect guy to sort of highlight that. There are a number of players who fit that mold. Cam Brown in the 10th round out of TCU, Marty Gaier in the 13th round out of Florida Southwestern, a number of other pitchers that kind of fit into that mold, but those three I think are the biggest ones. So it was a very, I would say the Phillies took on a lot of risk in this draft class, just given some of the profiles they went after, but I really appreciate it. It feels like the Phillies are a team that just take the best player available regardless. And I think Aiden Miller at 27 to start things off is pretty great value, because again, I think he was regarded as one of the best hit power players in the high school class. Like after Walker Jenkins, I'm not sure how many other players you can be as excited about both their hitting ability and power potential, that combination for the offensive profile. So what do you think about this Phillies draft?
Yeah, I mean, you'll be more well-versed on the three high school kids than I will, but Miller was a pick that I liked, especially at 27. You mentioned the track record of performance. He's a kid who can really hit. He's, I'd say, pretty physical, where the hit power combination is pretty impressive for a high school player. It's big time hand speed, barrels really moving through the zone. And I think that at least from what I saw, it was at least an above average arm, borderline plus, that's going to allow him to stick at third long term, which I think is a key. And then with Saltavon, I don't know too much about him. Like you said, I just know he's a guy that rose pretty late. And then with Walton, I know he's been a name for a while now. He's as physical as they come. again, there's questions, like you said, with the health and staying healthy, but super, super physical kid. And it's a big time upside play.
Yeah. And you don't really go under the radar too much if you're at IMG Academy, part to kind of sneak under the radar there, but all three of those guys in their pro debuts, Walton's is not a huge sample, but is pretty loud in his 17 plate appearances. He hit a triple. He doubled twice. It's an OPS over 1,200. Saltavon looked good. Aiden Miller got 80 plate appearances. Hit 303, 425, 379. So that looked pretty good. Good strikeout to walk rate for him. You mentioned the hand speed of Aiden Miller. I think that is one of the things I'm most excited about with him. He had really electric bat speed. Maybe some of the best just pure bat speed in the class. And his swing, it's not the prototypical swing that you maybe would teach people. There is a pretty significant hand hitch and barrel tip in his load. But I think, and this was the case with really all the scouts I asked about this, they had no issues with it. It's almost more of a timing mechanism for him. And he has such fast hands that he's able to kind of get away with that movement. And it looks pretty good when it's synced up and on time, even though it's maybe more moving parts than you would describe as like a picturesque swing. Just his impact, his swing decisions, I was always really impressed with. I agree with you about the arm strength. I would say it's a plus arm for him. He's old for the class, 19 on draft day. Would have been a draft eligible sophomore in 2025 if he did make it to campus, but I don't really get too worried about that for impact talents of the sort that we're talking about with Miller. But yeah, let's move down the board a little bit, getting some of these college players. Just the financials again, Philly seemed to play this relatively straight up. There weren't too many huge over under slot signees that you see with some other teams. Again, maybe that's because they didn't have a second rounder, they didn't have a fifth rounder. Kind of limits how creative you're able to get, but I do think that if I was running a draft, I would like to play things straight up. So I appreciate this sort of line of strategy for the Phillies here.
Yeah, and you mentioned the arms that they took. It was interesting. There weren't a ton of guys that are pitchability type of pitchers, especially looking at Klassen and Jake Edington, even like you said, Marty Gare. I think Klassen is probably the most famous, I guess you could say, of the arms that they took. Most notably was up to 102 in the Northwoods League, Major League Dreams Showcase, I think they call it. Whatever their all-star game is, he was up to 102 in the summer of 2022. Strike throwing has always been a huge issue for him. I think his freshman year, it was he missed most of it or all of it, but sophomore year came back, it was borderline 20 command. Wasn't quite 20 command this year. It was more like a 30, but they transitioned him to a starting role instead of him throwing out of the bullpen. In 13 starts, he only struck out 49 across 56 innings pitched and walked 47. I'd say those are really unimpressive numbers. I hate to nitpick like that, but those are super.
A nitpick, Peter, you're fine.
But again, the fastball, if you look at the velo on it, he'll pitch with it 96, 99, touch 100 and 101 rather regularly, but he gets no misses with it. It only had a 17% miss rate this year. The slider is super inconsistent, and you mentioned the control or lack thereof. And it's a dangerous equation, I think, with Klassen in terms of, you know, potentially having a pan out. I think that the future is definitely in the bullpen region. Just say, okay, you're gonna be a fastball slider guy, because the slider, from what I saw, especially in the Northwoods, I mean, a few that he threw and ripped off had some serious teeth where they had solid plus shape and action, where I think you just say, okay, go to the bullpen, fastball slider, you're gonna be one of the more effective relievers at the minor league level. We're gonna try and get you to that point. I think that's the play with Klassen. And then with Edington, similarly, it was 40 walks and I think 58 innings this year, or 55 innings, I think, at Missouri State. Mm-hmm. But with Edington, again, fastball up to 98, only miss rate of 17. So a couple of interesting picks back to back. I do like getting Bryson Ware in the eighth. I'm a big fan of college hitters with a track record of performance, especially with Ware doing it in the SEC. He had 350 this year with 24 bombs. I know that there's been some serious swing and miss early on in Clearwater, but I think that they got him for only 150,000. So that was a guy that I liked. And then in the ninth, not to talk about every single day one pick or day two pick rather, but Avery Owusu-Asiedu, 6'4", 230-pound outfielder from Southern Illinois, Edwardsville, not the Salukis. He was, I think, a late riser, at least like in terms of the general public finding out about him. He was a data darling this year. Super, super physical. Batted ball data was really impressive. Plus runner who's still 24 bags. He was a guy that popped up late where people, I think, were kind of like, whoa, you know, who is this guy? And I, so far, again, he's only been at the complex, which he just turned 20. So I think he's pretty young for the class. He's a 3-year college guy. He turned 20, I think, right before the draft, and modest numbers so far. But again, I think that there's some interesting upside here with Owusu-Asiedu.
Yeah, a few late players that I wanted to talk through a little bit more. Cam Brown being their final pick on day two is interesting. I got to see him in high school when he really probably was the best he's been in his time as like a nationally known prospect. It was like an electric three-pitch mix. I think I actually saw him at the first PDP league that was at IMG Academy. And he looked phenomenal, just like three pitches that looked like above average offerings. Physical frame, he was like putting all of them in the zone, really mixing and matching well. The next spring, it was the 2020 shortened season. He didn't look quite as electric. And so maybe if it was a normal year, he would have kind of evened things out, gotten a little bit better, and maybe not even gotten to campus. But he did get to campus, never really showed the same feel that I saw the first time I saw him in person. I think the stuff is still pretty loud. It's up to 97 with the fastball. The command is erratic. The slider had a pretty good whiff rate, mid-80s pitch, pretty good spin and two-plane break at times. He needs more refinement of that pitch. I think it's an upper 80s changeup with pretty good run and life. That also looks like a solid pitch. He just doesn't control them very well. In college, his walk rate was almost 6 per 9. And then in a very brief pro debut this summer, you kind of saw that control rear its head. It was 8 walks in just 1.2 innings for Cam Brown. It's obviously the big question with him. If he can throw that stuff for strikes, I think there is upside here. But we just have a pretty long track record of him now struggling to do that. Another bat that I don't think is a or was a really prominent showcase pony type is 11th rounder Caden Hettinger. Out of California, catcher. I just watched some of the swing on video. I'm really fascinated with it. It's quick and whippy and powerful. I think he does a good job getting a lot of force into the swing. Just a fascinating actual swing for me. The fact that he's a catcher, maybe he can stick behind the plate. He's going to need to improve at the position. But the bat speed and pitch recognition skills that he's shown are really fascinating to me for a day three high school player who they got to sign, which they did sign everyone in this class, but getting a player of this sort of talent at the position, another guy who's a little bit older for the class, he's 19 on draft day, like Aiden Miller, so clearly the Phillies aren't too concerned about the age question. He's a fascinating one. Then Marty Gehr. I mean, it's hard not to mention Marty Gehr. He was throwing 98, 99 miles per hour in high school out of the Charlotte area in North Carolina. Has very little feel for where that ball is going. The secondaries are erratic. He has shown a solid slider at times, but it's inconsistent both in terms of just shape and location. So he's kind of another of these really impressive arm talent pitchers that really need to learn how to be actual pitchers. So there are a lot of interesting names throughout this draft class that I'm fascinated by. I don't think there are a lot of really safe picks that you can feel great about. I mean, maybe the safest pick here is either Miller, depending on what you think of that profile, or maybe Bryson Ware, who they took in the 8th round. So it's a really fun draft class, certainly for an observer who doesn't have any investment in it personally.
In terms of looking at who might be the safest here, I would agree with you and probably taking Aiden Miller, which very rarely do you kind of circle the high school bat that you took as your safest bet.
Who was injured all spring.
Exactly. Who didn't even play this spring. But a really interesting class. Gehr was a guy that I was going to hit on. As you mentioned, it's thunderous stuff. He just has no clue where it's going and really lacks polish, but it's supreme arm talent. And if they can get him to figure out how to throw strikes, clean up the operation a little bit, he's got a chance. But Brandon Beckel in the 12th is probably the day three pick that I like the most. Was Texas Tech's best reliever this year. 2.2 ERA with 67 Ks and 48 innings pitched. Fastball again was pitched 93 to 96 pretty comfortably. Slider was the best off-speed offering. I think it was a plus pitch, had a 46% miss rate. So I think that, again, when you're looking towards safest picks, it's kind of crazy. You've got the high school bat who didn't play this spring in the first round, or you've got a college reliever in the 12th, or I guess you could say Bryson Ware as well. But in terms of the pitching side, the safest may have been a college reliever in the 12th, which speaks to the uniqueness of the Phillies draft class. But yeah, like you said, there's a lot of high ceiling, low floor guys. So if they hit on even a few of them, it's going to look pretty impressive in a handful of years. But we'll see.
I appreciate this sort of draft strategy. They're a team that's obviously really invested in high school right-handers in the first round in recent years. That's not a demographic that everyone likes to play with. And in a league where it seems like teams are getting more and more risk averse, I appreciate the teams that don't mind taking on some risk and the talent, the tools, and the athleticism you kind of get in exchange for that. So I'm on board. I hope some of these picks pan out, so more teams maybe will decide to get a little bit more risky in the draft because, you know, it's just more fun that way. But let's move on to the Marlins. One of the most fascinating draft classes, I think, of the entire league. A team that I probably was the most wrong on when looking at projecting their first round. It really felt like all of the talk around the Marlins at pick number 10, really for probably a month leading up to the draft, was hitter, 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 hitter. Some people were like, oh, they're definitely going to do college hitter here. They need more hitting in the farm system. A lot of the bats haven't looked great. And they decided to double up on high school pitching with their first two picks. So did the exact opposite of what I expected them to do. But I honestly think I really like this strategy a lot for them. And our draft reviews that we put out really right after the draft ended, their theme seemed to be play to your strengths. The Marlins have a pretty strong contrast in success with pitching development versus hitter development. And I think where they're picking in the draft, Noble Meyer very easily could have been the best talent overall on the board. So taking him is good regardless of your track record, I think. And then getting a player like Thomas White at number 35, who I think is another first round talent, and basically locking up the elite high school pitchers of this class as an organization that's done a really great job developing arms, I think is awesome. Now, maybe you want to diversify the farm system a little bit. Maybe you'd want to take some hitters, but they've taken some hitters high up in this range in the past, and it hasn't really worked out too well between Khalil Watson, Jacob Berry so far. So I kind of like playing to your strengths and taking this sort of elite talent that you get with players like Noble Meyer and Thomas White. But to run through their first five rounds really quickly, obviously Noble Meyer at 10, Thomas White at 35. In the second round, they took Mississippi outfielder Kemp Alderman. They took Michigan State first baseman Brock Vredenburg in the third. They took Emmett Olson, pitcher out of Nebraska, in the fourth. And then they took Andrew Lindsey, another pitcher out of college, in the fifth round, him out of Tennessee. So that's kind of how they went in the top five rounds. What are your thoughts on the Marlins?
I think that we share the same sentiment with being excited about the fact that they got both Noble Meyer and Thomas White. I think it's hard not to be. Heading into the draft, they were kind of talked about as the top two, arguably, in terms of sheer talent, prep arms. I know a handful went before White, but they were kind of talked about for most of the cycle as 1A and 1B in terms of prep arms. I think that I was super excited when they got Meyer 10th overall. Like you mentioned, I think that there was an argument he made at the time. He was maybe the best one available on the board. Great body at 6'5". He moves well. Fastball like 95, 98. It with tons of run and ride through the zone. He's got a hellacious high-80 slider that I think is a double plus pitch. Spins it routinely in the 29 to 3,000 range. And then I also think that the changeup is a plus offering with tons of fade. And you look at all these ingredients that Meyer brings, and I think that he's a future front of the rotation arm, someone that can be your headliner, maybe 3 to 5 years down the road. And you mentioned the track record of developing arms, and the Marlins have an underrated, impressive one. So I think that these are two exciting guys. And with Thomas White, he's been a name since he was 13 years old and throwing 91 with a gorgeous delivery. He's kept that same delivery through high school. It's really clean. I wonder a little bit about the arm action, and if whether or not it might lead to an injury or Tommy John surgery down the road. But again, he's up to an effortless 96 with a curveball that's flash plus. I think the key for him is going to be refining the command and control, and then slowing down a little bit on the mound. I think that the one thing I notice with him is he gets a little sped up when there's traffic on the bases. I think keeping level-headed will go a long way with him. But other than that, if he can progress with the strike throwing and continue to add a third offering, that'll go a long way with White.
Yeah, I like how you described his delivery because I think some people might be a little confused when you said it's like a super easy delivery, but you were also concerned about the arm action. I view it very similarly. It's a pretty lengthy arm action in the back, and I think that could have some issues with just the timing and the consistency of him repeating his slot. And so hitting on that breaking ball consistently It does flash plus at times, but I think the changeup, at least in the last year or so, has maybe been his most consistent secondary and the one that I'm most confident in. I also think he can be a little scattered, but you don't see many pitchers of his size that are throwing upper 90s velocity with the ease that it seems to come out of his hand. Like, there's very little recoil or head whack or movement at all once he's coming through his finish. It really does look like he's just kind of playing a simple game of catch when he's pumping fastballs over the plate. And so just to get a left-handed pitcher with that sort of arm talent is pretty special. I think the fact that you get him at 35 while also getting a guy like Noble Meyer, who I think has the better combination of stuff and current pitchability, has to make you feel good, even if you did go pretty significantly over slot to get him there. And then maybe adding some college bats behind those guys to diversify your portfolio a little bit. But let's move further down the board. One name that I was really intrigued with on day two, who I know is a name that you like, so I'll just kind of tee him up, is Justin Storm in the seventh round. I think you kind of highlighted to me in season how unique some of his, just the combination of his pitches and handedness really was. But I'm fascinated in him and the pure stuff, and getting him with your seventh round pick, I think is a pretty exciting one. But in addition to Storm, I guess who are some other pitchers who you're intrigued with?
Yeah, I think circling back a little bit to the bats that they took, I can't say I'm the biggest fan of going Alderman, Vredenburg in the second and third rounds, respectively. They're two guys, at least positionally, that I think at best are probably married to first base. Alderman is, you know, the calling card with Alderman is his 70 raw power and the unbelievable impact that he has. Yeah. I think his max exit was 119, I want to say. There's a chance it was even 121, but
if you look at the we plotted exit velocity, contact, and chase, I think, a couple times this year, and if you look at Alderman's plot on that graph, he's basically up and to the far left with crazy exit velocities but also really crazy contact concerns. So it's a ton of power, it's not a lot of plate discipline or contact, and I even think early on in pro ball, we've seen that. It's like 39 strikeouts, 7 walks, and 133 plate appearances for him. But yeah, both him and Vredenburg are very much power-oriented corner profiles.
Yeah, there's a ton of swing and miss with Alderman, as you mentioned, some approach concerns. And honestly, the same with Vredenburg. And I think that it may have gotten a little masked with his performance at Michigan State to kind of paint the picture of who this guy is. He's a towering 6'7", 230-pound first baseman. He almost looks like a villain in like a baseball movie in Rookie of the Year. He looks like that guy, except he's not as fat, who hit the Henry Rowan Gardner floater pitch. He's got a much better physical look than that, but he hit 400 this year at Michigan State with 22 doubles and 13 jacks. More walks than strikeouts, which when looking at the back of the baseball card, you can kind of question maybe why, you know, why the swing and miss and approach might be a little bit of an issue. The miss against secondary stuff and chase rate against secondary stuff was a little high this spring at Michigan State, especially in the Big Ten. And so far in Jupiter, it's kind of exposed itself a little bit. It's 37 strikeouts and 110 at bats. He is still walking at a respectable clip. He's drawn 22 walks. But so far some swing and miss for Vredenburg. But you mentioned Justin Storm. It's exclusively fastball slider, 6'7" reliever, super, super imposing. At one point, I think he was one of a handful of pitchers in college baseball where I'll have to find the exact stat, but it was something about the miss rate on both his fastball and slider. That stat doesn't hold true anymore with, him ending up at still an impressive 28% miss rate on it this spring, for a pitch that he threw 68% of the time. But he'll be up to 95, hides the ball really well. I think that again, getting him in the eighth and viewing him as someone you can develop as a reliever, I think that you have to be really excited about it. And they got him for 240,000, maybe a little bit of a reach, money wise, but again, I think that you can always be excited about a 6'7" lefty with 2+ pitches.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they basically had Thomas White as an overslot deal in the supplemental first. They had Vredenburg for slot exactly in the third. Outside of that, everyone was underslot essentially to pay for Thomas White. So that's kind of how they operated financially. Let's see if there's anything else they did money-wise that is worth mentioning here. They were one of the teams that didn't use their full bonus pool, so I guess we could shame them a little bit for that here. They spent 99.5% of their total bonus pool, 12.7, just over 12.7 million. They had 12.8 to spend, so maybe you could argue that they could have been a little more aggressive later on. Again, maybe it's tricky when you're taking Meyer and Thomas White, making sure you have the money to get White, because obviously your class is reliant on signing both those players. So maybe with high school players at the top, it's a little tougher to criticize teams for not optimizing their spending in the bonus pool. Any other day three picks to mention or later names that we haven't talked through here? Tristan Dietrich in the 18th round was kind of interesting to me. But yeah, anything else for you? They didn't sign Dietrich, but it would have been nice if they did.
Yeah, so I actually have two. One was their last pick
Oh.
on day two. The second was a middle of day three guy. 10th round pick Xavier Meacham from North Carolina A&T.
He's been really good in pro
He was
ball.
always kind of viewed as an under. Yeah, he's always been viewed and always was viewed as a little bit of an under the radar guy in scouting circles. The stuff was always really impressive. Just again, command and strike throwing was a little bit of an issue. He can really spin his breaking ball. This year again at North Carolina A&T, rather modest. But early returns so far in pro ball have been outstanding. The strike throwing has taken a step forward. At least you can, I guess you can call it a step forward, even though it's only been 20 innings, or 20 and a third. But 28 Ks to 12 walks, with a 2.6 ERA. Again, the calling card with Meacham is ability to spin the breaking ball. And then the fastball, I think, has been up to 95, 96 ish. So I think it's really intriguing upside there with him. And then Nigel Belgrave in the 15th, a reliever out of Maryland. 6'4", 195, pretty physical kid. He had an impressive week this past week, especially with Jupiter. That kind of reminded me that the Marlins got him, so I decided to dig deeper. Again, someone that the strike throwing is going to have to, I think, progress and continue to progress. But so far, it's been a really effective reliever for the Hammerheads of Jupiter. 14 Ks in 8 innings, mid to high 90s fastball. So those are two guys that both based on who they are as players and then track record, or I guess performance so far, I think that the Marlins can be happy about. And then sandwiched in between those two, I guess pure stuff over command guys is 11th rounder Jake Brooks from UCLA. Dealt with an injury that kind of hindered him, I'd say, for the better part of, last year and then maybe this year a little bit. But he's a strike thrower. He'll only be up to, 89, 92 with a fastball. It'll kind of sink and dive out of the strike zone. He throws nothing straight. Sliders average. Strike throwing is the calling card. It's not a super, super sexy pick, I'd say. It is probably fifth starter upside with Brooks, but I think that you can be happy about the strike throwing. He's got a good body, 6'4", 210. I think the key with him is going to be staying healthy, and maybe getting some better shape out of that slider, because the changeup has flash plus, and the fastball, it doesn't get a ton of swing and miss, but he throws nothing straight. And if you can get the slider into even an above average pitch, I think it'll go a long way for his arsenal.
Yeah, well said, Peter. I appreciate the insight on those guys. That's all I had on the Marlins. Let's move on to the Mets. They're one of two teams, along with the Dodgers, who had their first round pick dropped 10 spots for exceeding the bonus pool, or not the bonus pool, it's the luxury tax. So they picked number 32 overall for their first selection. They also had a couple extra picks after the fourth round. So let's run through there. So they had three, technically three fourth round picks, so a few extra ones. They also had a pick in the third round for failing to sign Brandon Sproat a year ago. So they had a few extra picks to work through, but they took Colin Houck, Georgia High School shortstop in the first round. Technically the first round, I guess, if you want to call that supplemental, that works too, 32 overall. They took Brandon Sproat once again in the second round this year. They said you were definitely going to be a New York Met after not signing him a year ago. He's a right-handed pitcher out of Florida. In the third round out of Oklahoma State University, they took two-way player Nolan McLean, who was additionally a player who was drafted last year and did not sign. Their next pick at 101, another third round pick, Cade Morris, a pitcher out of Nevada. Then they had three picks in the fourth round. It was Wyatt Hudepohl, shortstop AJ Ewing, and then Austin Trosser out of Missouri. And their fifth round pick to round this all out was Grand Canyon University pitcher Zach Thornton. So a ton of names to go through here, in addition to a number of intriguing players beyond that. The Mets stood out to me more than any other team in targeting priority older players. They had a number of 22-year-olds who are technically senior sign types, but are certainly more than just money savers. Brandon Sproat and McLean are both kind of the epitome of that. I also thought taking Noah Hall in the seventh round, and then in the ninth round taking Nick LaRusso, they really took a lot of these players who have real tools, real talent, who are seniors, but maybe you get a little bit better cost control with those players than you otherwise would have. Just looking through some of the bonuses here, it's not a ton of savings. Noah Hall signed for about $60,000 under slot in the seventh round. LaRusso signed for $125,000 under slot in the ninth round, but both Sproat and McLean went for straight up slot value in the second round and third round. So it's kind of interesting to see that they had so many of those players who I think are still really valuable prospects. They don't fit in the typical senior sign mold, but it's interesting they had so many of those types. But I'll let you jump in here. What stands out to you about the Mets draft?
Yeah, I'd say I'm a sneaky fan of this draft class that they got. I mean, you'll be more well versed in Colin Houck than I am. But I saw
one of my favorite value picks, and I think he was probably my favorite just straight up high school shortstop in this class of a really good group of high school shortstops. So I think him at 32 is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, you can go more in depth on him, but I saw a clean operation in the box with plus bat speed. He's a performer at these high profile events. He performed well at Area Code and East Coast Pro. Above average runner, who's a great athlete. I like the body a lot. Again, you're going to be more well versed in him, so you can maybe go a bit more in depth on who he is.
Yeah, he's a two-sport athlete, a really talented high school quarterback. He plays at Parkview High, which is maybe the most recognizable Georgia high school in the country. I mean, they are a multi-team of the year winner at Baseball America. They produced a lot of really good talent in the past, so it's not some under-the-radar school there. He was one of the most impressive names last summer. I think he was not the most highly regarded Georgia prospect entering the summer, but he certainly was after leaving. Like you said, his performance there was really impressive. I think it's just solid average or better tools across the board. It wouldn't shock me if it was straight 55s across the board. It's a good athlete on the left side of the infield. I think he's got a chance to stick at shortstop. If the body gets a little bit bigger, I think he's got the tools to play a really athletic third base. It's highlight reel plays, diving grabs, big arm strength, and just a solid hit power combination. It's mostly doubles power right now, but he has turned on a few balls with wood. I think as he adds strength and gets to his physical maturity, it wouldn't be surprising to see him with 50 or 55 power as well. So I just thought it was a really well-rounded, athletic high school shortstop who performed against good pitching, and that's typically a really good demographic and one that I find myself really liking. So if you're starting off the draft with him at pick 32, I'm going to probably be a fan of what you're doing. And I think, like you said, I'm probably also a fan of what is a pretty sneaky good draft class.
Yeah, and I think that you have me now completely sold on the Houck pick, and it sounds like getting him at 32 is it's going to look really good in a year or three. But I think moving on to Sproat, getting him again at 56, kind of like Houck at 32, I think that it's a pretty good spot to land an arm talent like Brandon Sproat. You mentioned him getting picked by the Mets last year, didn't end up signing, goes back to Florida and held down that rotation with Hurst and Waldrop. They were arguably the best 1-2 punch in the country, at least in terms of sheer stuff. But 134 strikeouts and 106 innings pitched. I think that he was inconsistent in his command at times, lacked some feel, but when he was on, I mean, he looked as good as any arm in the country. Fastball was 96 to 100, up to 101, and it just explodes out of his hand with tons of life through the zone. The changeup is a plus pitch, borderline double plus with a ton of arm side fade. The slider is also a plus pitch. When you start to put these guys in buckets of, you know, who has three legitimate plus pitches in the draft class, you're not going to get a lot of names there. And I think that Sproat is one of them. Waldrop is certainly another. But when you're looking at Sproat's ceiling, there's obviously some risk associated with this pick, just in terms of where he is long term. But like, it is one or two starter upside. And I think that having him fall into their laps again at 56, it has a chance to work out really well. And then I think with McLean in the third at 91, I have my own opinions on that pick. I think that McLean has, you know, he's been known for his unbelievable raw power at the plate. That's who he is. He's kind of a one trick pony, in the box.
There's
a ton
hitting.
Of swing and miss. Exactly. I'm with you. So far they've let him do both. But I think that he, you know, long-term, the arm talent is pretty exciting, with McLean. He's certainly a reliever, in my opinion, but big time velo, showed feel, and I think spun a few plus sliders. I think that it's an interesting pick in the third. But again, it's a fun player type, that fans, I think, will have fun following through the system.
Yeah. I think Nolan McLean to me is like the best example of player who's like a viable two-way player as an amateur, but I just wish players like this would realize where their upside was in the future earlier so that they could focus on their better side. And for him, I definitely think it's as a pitcher. Like, he has a legitimate fastball, legitimate breaking ball, a workhorse frame, a pretty good delivery. Like, there is a ton to like for him as a pitcher. And I don't even think he was a very good just pure hitter in college with just the contact questions that he has. I just don't see any way for that bat to play in pro ball. I mean, right now he's sitting with, it's only 24 plate appearances. Again, we talk about this for a lot of these guys, small sample for just a performance, but it's already a 45% strikeout rate in pro ball as a college guy. So I just don't think he's ever going to get to the real plus raw power that he has in game. And I do think there's real upside here as a pitcher. So I'm really hopeful that he can start focusing on pitching soon in his pro career, because I am very excited about him as a pitcher, maybe more than you seem to be on the mound, Peter. But man, it makes the overall evaluation a little bit trickier when I just have absolutely no faith in the hitting ability, and I'm really intrigued and wish we had more of a sample of him actually getting on the mound and pitching.
Yeah, the arm talent is unbelievable, and I think that it would have been hard to make this adjustment after a sophomore year in which he hit 285 with 16 doubles and 19 bombs, was hitting the heart of that really impressive Oklahoma State lineup. But after that sophomore year, I would have made the difficult choice to really, really focus on pitching, maybe not go PO at that point, but to really put an emphasis on the pitching, because as you mentioned, the arm talent is really, really exciting. So I think that he's going to be a fun one to watch, and see how the pitching progresses long term. But they kind of went, I mean, they have him listed as a third baseman on the draft selection, but I mean, they took a slew of college arms in the middle round, sandwiched with AJ Ewing, who I like Ewing a lot. I really like the swing. He's got really quick hands. He's a twitchy player. Again, you might be able to go more in depth on him, but he was a high school guy when I saw him get picked in the fourth that I was hoping they'd be able to sign, because I really liked him.
Yeah, I think AJ Ewing was always a player that Ben was particularly high on. I know he really loved the hitting ability. I mean, Ewing is not the most physically imposing player like a Nolan McLean actually is. He's pretty small and thin. But the bat speed and the power that he's shown despite that size in high school has been impressive. It's a pretty big swing with some moving parts, but he's done a nice job using his hands, getting on plane, firing through the zone, making a lot of contact. So it's been like a kind of surprisingly impactful hitter, despite that physicality. I think it's probably more of a second base than a shortstop at the next level, but if you think he's going to add a little bit more strength, if you really buy into the hit tool like I know Ben does, it's a middle infielder that you think can be a solid defender, runs a little bit, and I guess just depending on the power that he gets to will really determine the role. He's not a ton different than another high school infielder they took a few picks later in the eighth round in Boston Barrow. They signed him actually for a little bit more than AJ Ewing. Ewing signed for $675,000. Boston Barrow signed for $700,000. Barrow was another player who is kind of behind the curve a little bit, just physically. He's very underdeveloped. He's going to need to add strength. That's maybe the biggest question with him now, but he's got a really clean, smooth left-handed swing, solid tools across the board. It's more of a line drive and a level swing now, but good contact ability, solid swing decisions. It's good actions in the infield. I think probably a better chance to actually stick at shortstop. Above average arm strength maybe is the key there for him. Not quite the runner that Ewing has been, but just does a lot of things well. I don't think there's a ton of difference between like the player that Barrow is now and say like a Mikey Romero type, another kind of smaller hit first California shortstop, although Romero certainly was more prominent at the same time. But he's another player where if you can dream on some physicality being added, there are a lot of things to like, and I think his skill set as a baseball player is fairly advanced. So those are two kind of interesting prep guys.
Yeah, I certainly am a believer in Ewing's hit tool. I know that he's going to really have to hit, especially with him probably being a second baseman long term and being a hit over power guy, even if he does that impact. But I know that, again, when I saw him go off the board, that he's a guy that piqued my interest. And then I looking at a lot of these college arms that they took, it's hard to pick one to kind of talk about. Cade Morris was a he. He exploded onto the scene starting last summer when he outdueled Carson Wisenhunt in that first start of the Cape League season. Really made a name for himself and established himself as one of the premier arms in the 23 class after that. He was up to 97. Slider was pretty good, at least in that start. But he threw for Nevada in the Mountain West, which notoriously is, at least for my money's worth, the hardest conference to pitch in. Every single yard is a launch pad. And he was initially going to transfer to TCU from Nevada, but that ended up falling through. So he stayed with the Wolfpack this spring. Again, fastball was 93 to 96. The slider was, it flashed above average. I think the key for him is going to be the continued development of his secondary stuff. And getting more misses with his fastball because his fastball got hit really at all levels. That was the one bugaboo, even on the Cape. Guys were hitting it pretty hard with wood. So I think, getting some more action, getting more life on it will go a long way for Morris. And then Austin Trozor in the fourth, straight reliever in my mind, but an impressive fastball slider combination again. Two plus pitch kind of guy, fastball up to 98, with really good traits. And then Zach Thornton from Grand Canyon. He's a JUCO
Love this one, yeah.
transfer. Yeah, I like him a lot too. Again, upside wise, it's back of the rotation. But he was outstanding this year for the Antelopes. High three-quarter slot. There's some natural deception in his, I think, a pretty up-tempo delivery. He was a strike thrower, gets some pretty good natural tilt. And keeps hitters off balance. I think the fastball plays up from its 89 to 91 or 2 velo just due to him hiding the ball really well. And I think that the curveball, even though he didn't throw it a lot, I liked that. I thought that was his better secondary pitch as opposed to a slider. It has bigger shape. So I think that's a really intriguing one there in the fifth.
Yeah, kind of as you're talking through all these players, I think it's kind of gone a little under my radar just how much talent the Mets are able to add this year with all these picks. I like a lot of the players And one last guy that I'll mention, because we have spent a lot of time on specific players here, and then I'll let you see if there's any day three guys you like. But a name that was always super fascinating to me ever since I really got notice of him is seventh rounder Noah Hall out of South Carolina. He was a senior sign. I think he probably would have been a top five rounds guy if he hadn't dealt with some back injuries that really ended his season early. He didn't pitch after a March 31st outing against Mississippi State. But he sits in the 90 95 mile per hour range with his fastball, will touch a six, has a low 80s changeup and a mid 80s slider. The changeup specifically is what's really fascinating to me about Hall. It's a super high spin changeup, which you don't see very often. It's almost like Devin Williams-esque. And I think it's a legitimate 70 grade pitch. It was nearly a 30% usage rate, and he got a 55% whiff rate with the pitch. It's just huge spin rates, a ton of arm side movement and drop. It's almost like a screwball at times with the amount of movement that it has towards his arm side. And it's been a true out pitch for him against both righties and lefties. So just that like unique changeup for Hall was pretty fascinating. And he pitched really well in a starting capacity this spring before he got limited. Now, he is older. The medical will add some complications to this. It's not huge fastball velocity. But just having a pitch like that changeup that Hall has is super exciting to me right off the bat. So hopefully he can get healthy and we can see that in pro ball and see how it plays.
Yeah, I'm really happy you mentioned Hall. Again, someone like you said was super impressive before the injury. I'm kind of happy that the Mets weren't super scared off by it because, as you mentioned, from these eyes as well, it was a borderline seven changeup with those super unique spin traits, almost like you said, Devin Williams in terms of the spin. So I think getting someone like that in the seventh, where if he was healthy, could have gone as early as maybe even the late third round. I think that they can be really happy with that. They got him for 180,000. So I think that's a win in a lot of areas for the Mets. And then on day three, one, when running down this class, I was impressed, but even talking it through, I'm even more impressed. Obviously pitching heavy, but there are a couple of arms that, and they'll be relievers long term. So I know you can only get so excited about it, but Brett Banks from UNC Wilmington is one guy that they got in the 11th with super impressive stuff. I think that he was one of the leaders, if not the leader, on College Stuff Plus leaderboards with 44 Ks in 38 innings, fastballs up to 99, really impressive slider. When he has a feel for it. Again, pitchability is a little lacking, but again, fastball slider combination that both are plus pitches, and you're betting on the upside here with Banks. And then in the 17th, a little bit of a deeper pull here, Bryce Jenkins from Tennessee. Didn't pitch a ton for Tennessee this year, just given the personnel that they have. Again, 24 Ks in 16 innings. Fastball when I saw him, so he pitched for the Cape this year, pitched on the Cape this year, prior to the draft, which I think that really helped him and establish himself as a draft pick. Fastball is up to 95 with really impressive spin traits and other metrics, and then the slider is a legit plus pitch, and he spun it consistently in the 28 to 3,000 range. And he profiles as someone where if he can continue to throw strikes, where I know that it's been a little bit of a struggle in a minuscule sample size, you could kind of see him sneak his way and creep his way up through the system. I think that they got a real steal there in the 17th because if he had the normal workload and was relied on as heavily as other setup and closers around college baseball, he probably goes in the 12th to 14th round range.
Yeah, so that is the Mets. I think, kind of like you said, as we've talked through this class, I found myself liking it more and more. Just a lot of really quality prospects added to the system that maybe don't get as much hype as some other players, but really like a lot of traits and skills and tools from a number of them. A lot of really exciting arms in addition to some fun and maybe more typical high school shortstop profiles mixed in that group. So let's move on to the Nationals, the last team in the NL East. every year there are a few teams that really have a draft that just feels like that sort of organization's draft. I think the 2023 Nationals draft really feels like the Nationals to me, at least. They took a lot of powerful, toolsy athletes, and they also were maybe the best example of a team that spends early and saves later, when the most common strategy seems to be that portfolio approach where you take a deal early on and spread your money around. The Nationals basically did the exact opposite of that. They took Dylan Cruz, number two overall, who we had as the top overall player on the board. Again, I think the top three players, especially, you could say, are pretty close, and that the top five group of players overall was kind of viewed as that elite group of talent. They took Yohandy Morales on an overslot deal in the second round. Then they took Travis Sikora in the third round to a pretty significant overslot deal. Fourth and fifth rounders, they took Andrew Pinckney, senior, in the fourth round. Then they took Marcus Brown, a shortstop, in the fifth round. After those players, in the 6 to 10 round range for the Nationals, it was all senior signs for 20,000 a pop, basically to make sure the team got their top three players signed. So a really aggressive strategy, almost like a Stars and Scrubs approach that really, I think the Nationals had a reputation for on the big league team when they won their World Series. So it's kind of funny to see the draft pan out like that as well. But what are your thoughts on the Nationals?
Yeah, I honestly I like the class so far, and these are guys that in at least early on have been performing really well in affiliated baseball. Obviously, starting with Dylan Cruz, everyone knows who Cruz is at this point. There's really, no use in talking about him too much. But beautiful operation at the plate. It's easy plus bat speed, hammers the baseball all fields. Good athlete out in center where they. I think that they're going to plan on having him stick there. I know that he's played. I think that in his 17 games in Harrisburg, it's been 13 in center, 4 in right. So they plan on having him in center long term. Drives the ball with authority to all fields. I think that right now it's a little bit hit over power, and I think that's what he's going to be for his career. But the hit tool is really, really impressive. Approach is outstanding, and when you have that feel for the barrel with the bat speed that he does, it's an impressive combination, and rightfully so. He's hit his way to double A already, where it's been a little bit of an adjustment. I'd say double A, at least talent wise, is the closest thing you're going to get to Major League Baseball. Little bit more swing and miss. But again, you're going from, for as impressive as the SEC is, getting to double A that soon after college. There's going to be an adjustment period, and it's such an old cliche and an old adage, but baseball is really, really hard, and it's normal to go through a little bit of an adjustment period. And then
Yeah, I think with just to add on to Cruz really quickly, like he was the number one player in a really outstanding draft class for a reason. I think I don't know a player who I've had as much conviction in their just offensive profile overall that I've had with a player like Cruz. Like I think he has every physical tool and skill that you need to succeed as a hitter. It's tremendous bat speed, it's tremendous vision, it's really strong swing decisions. It's a ton of raw power. I do agree with you. I think it'll probably be more hit over power, but I'm curious how that evolves because I do think it's pretty easy 60 raw power when he turns on the ball. He just seems to have an approach where he's perfectly fine driving a line drive through the opposite to the opposite field or hitting a hard ground ball up the middle. I know there's some criticism of the ground ball rate that he showed in college. I'm ultimately not too concerned with that. And I think the biggest change that I had with my evaluation of Cruz this spring, just being able to watch him more, is the center field defense is actually, I think it's really good. I think he can stick there long term, depending on who else is in the system. If you have some Kevin Kiermaier type outfielder, then yeah, I think Cruz will probably be better off in a corner where he might be a plus defender. But depending on who you're running out in center field at the major league level, I think Cruz could be a perfectly good defensive outfielder. And maybe I'm towards the optimistic range of that, but he really impressed me with his defense, and I just think he's such a well-rounded prospect. I have extremely high confidence in him being an above average big league regular with really likely all-star upside.
I completely agree. And with sticking in center, I was convinced. I mean, I had the privilege of watching him for almost 2 weeks in Omaha, and it was efficient routes to the baseball. It was pretty ample range in either gap. The off-the-bat reads were really, really impressive. He looked extremely, extremely comfortable out there in the arm. It's not plus by any means, but it's average or maybe even a tick below for center. Regardless, his arm is it'll be fine out there in center long term. And I'm with you that I'm still very, very convicted on him. Maybe the most convicted I am in a player in this draft class in terms of being an impact big leaguer. And I'm with you that he is going to play in multiple All-Star games when all is said and done.
And moving on to Yohanny Morales, he's been pretty tremendous in pro ball. I mean, just as a prospect, the raw power, the athleticism, the arm strength from the left side were always exciting. We talked about like comparing and contrasting him and Brock Wilkin this spring, some of the question marks we had about them. And maybe what's been most impressive to me, more than anything with Morales so far in his brief pro stint, has just been the walk rate and the strikeout rate. He's had a 420 OBP, I think, of this Nationals draft class. Just in terms of the back of the baseball card statistics, he's been the best player. He's not homered yet, but it's a ton of doubles. It's four triples. And like I said, having a strikeout rate that's just 20% and a walk rate that's 9% in pro ball for Morales, who I specifically had some kind of pitch recognition questions, I think is really encouraging. And if he's going to continue to maintain that sort of plate discipline with the physical tools that he has, I think he's got a pretty exciting amount of upside, particularly for a player who they got all the way down at pick 40, which I think was a little bit lower than I would have expected him to come off the board.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think that early on that Morales is going to be a player that I will happily eat crow on because I know during the spring that we discussed sort of him versus Brock Wilkin. I think I was on the Brock Wilkin train, and I think you were on the Morales wave.
Yeah, but I even can't claim to be super high because I remember being kind of skeptical of both. So even if I did pick Morales, I think probably because of his just base of athleticism. But both those guys are doing pretty good in pro ball right now. So what do we know?
Yeah, no, exactly. Like you mentioned with Yo-Yo, he's blessed with a great body, tons of physical tools. It was super, super easy impact at Miami. And I know it's a very different ball game with metal, but I mean, he was flicking balls and they were 108 to 110 miles an hour off the bat. And I mean, he's got a quick set of hands. Like you said, no homer so far. But he's finding gaps and hitting well at a high level of affiliated baseball too. He's another guy that just recently played his first double-A game, and then he was excellent in high-A Wilmington and in single-A Fredericksburg. So again, early returns have been really positive on Morales, and if they can end up with two high-impact big leaguers down the road with their first two draft picks, this is going to be a draft class that, you know, not to get dramatic here, but could shape the future of the franchise in a really positive way. And then I think that continuing on that note, Andrew Pinckney is another guy that they got in the fourth, an outfielder from Alabama, 6'3", 200. Again, really good body, good athlete. It's a plus arm in right field where he's going to stick. I think it's plus raw power at the plate again with Morales. He's got four home runs in 39 games. But I think it is plus power, and there's going to be more to come. He's already up in Double A Harrisburg so far in 39 games. Between the complex and Double A, he's hitting 320 with eight doubles and four home runs, 36 Ks and 153 at bats. He's got a super, super quick set of hands, really engaged lower half and an explosive backside. He was a guy that I was really excited watching this spring, just kind of seeing the gradual ascent on draft boards, because I think getting him in the fourth is a bit of a steal. And so far, the results have been really positive with Pinckney. But again, you mentioned guys sticking at their positions and kind of viewing the from early on, the premium positions always have been and always will be up the middle, catcher, shortstop, center field, what have you. But I think that second base is one that's being viewed as a premium position now. Sticking in general on the left side of the infield is another really big positive one with Morales, who's looking like he's going to stick at third. And then sticking in right field is another really positive one. And I think that Pinckney obviously fits that mold. You know, he's got good actions out there and the plus throwing arm. So I think that these are three college guys that they can be very, very excited about early on.
Yeah. And I'll circle back to the one high school player they took in this range. And it's funny, like talking about all these players they took, all of them are super physical and advanced. Like the fact that Dylan Cruz is the smallest player they took of their first four is pretty funny. And Travis Sikora, who's their one high school pick, is their most physically advanced of the group. 6'6", 220 pounds. He was older for the class, and he does fit that sort of scary high school right-handed pitcher demographic of just a very early hard thrower. He was throwing 100 miles per hour when he was a junior in high school. Probably the hardest throwing high school pitcher in this class. The fastball's consistently in the mid-90s, consistently up into the upper 90s. So it's a chance for a 70 fastball. The secondaries are solid, but they were always kind of unusual secondary pitches. The slider was this really short breaking mid-80s pitch that almost blended into his mid-80s split changeup at times. I remember being behind the dish watching Sikora pitch, and there were times where, depending on the angle you had, it was really hard to differentiate those pitches, even when you had, I would say, is the best view in baseball. So, like, I'm not sure if that's even necessarily a problem, because the slider against high school pitching would get misses, and he did show pretty solid feel for both of those pitches, the slider and the split change at times. I think overall, solid control considering his stuff in high school, but the track record of players who are throwing this hard in high school is a shaky one. The Nationals have taken a lot of these high-risk pitchers in the past. Not all of them have panned out for them. So hopefully Sikora is able to kind of buck that trend. But I'm really curious to see, one, what the control is going to be like in pro ball when he can't just overwhelm hitters with pure velocity. And then two, how the shape of his slider specifically changes, if it does, or if it's effective just being this like short kind of cutter-ish breaking ball, just how that develops. So he's certainly a really fun pick. I wouldn't say he's my like particular cup of tea as a high school pitching prospect, but there's no doubting the sort of raw arm talent that he has.
Yeah, and it's supreme arm talent. Like you mentioned, it's not like, I think, you know, again, it's not my cup of tea either. You know, he's 6'6", 230, he was 19 on draft day. Fastball, again, is probably the calling card, just given the premium velo there. It's, you know, 98 to 100, touching 101. Slider, really impressive. But when you kind of peek under the hood a little bit and look behind the curtain, it's kind of high risk, likely reliever down the road, high school arm. So there's some obvious risk involved there with Sikora. But I think that looking further down the draft board, Marcus Brown, I like at Oklahoma State, can really pick it. He's going to have to really, really hit professionally because there's not a ton of power there at all. But an exciting shortstop who's going to stick at the position. Again, it's going to be a matter of hitting, which we'll see if he's able to do. But Gavin Dugas is another in the sixth. I like getting, again, with Dugas, he's older for the class, really just older in general. Nothing jumps out physically, 5'10", 198. But the intangibles with Dugas are really, really positive. He was a leader in an LSU locker room that had tons of stars. He was a guy that, you know, was looked to and viewed as the team captain, so to speak, for the Tigers. And he performed really well. Again, as far as tool set goes, it's kind of average or a tick above at best for his carrying tools, which I think that it's probably just the hit tool and a tick above average raw power. But the intangibles with Dugas kind of fits the mold where those might be the carrying tool, so to speak, with him. But getting that guy in your organization, in your dugout, I think that he provides some value there. He's very, very old at 23, and they signed him for, I think it was 20K.
Yeah, 20,000. Every player from 6 to 10 for the Nationals were 20K senior signs. And I'm also realizing as you're talking, I'm pretty sure I've been pronouncing Gavin's name incorrectly the entire time I've talked about him. I didn't realize the S was silent.
Maybe I'm wrong too, because I've heard Dugas like on broadcast too. So like
So I've only
maybe.
ever thought Dugas in my head, and I just tried to pull it up on LSU's roster. They didn't have a pronunciation guide, but that would be kind of funny if just internally I'd been pronouncing and I guess saying his name incorrectly. We'll have to figure out what the
Yeah, I wish they did what like some schools do, where they have the like the players say the name, where you click the
yeah,
little ear thing. It's
that's
like
always super
Duga.
useful.
But anyways, in the 11th, I really wish that they were able to sign him, because when you talk about upside,
Oh, yeah.
your excitement in arms, Gavin Adams fits that mold to a T. 6'3" right-hander out of Indian River Community College in Florida. I mean, 6 foot, like his frame just oozes projection. Fastball is up to 98. Spun a really tight slider that I thought was a plus offering. He got a ton of swing and miss. Strike throwing with Dugas, I long term needs to take strides, but we don't have to harp on someone who didn't sign. But he was an interesting one in the 11th that I wish signed. Elijah Nunez in the 14th.
I'm glad you
Interesting.
mentioned Nunez. I really like him. He's kind of the like a little bit of an old school style outfielder and slappy hitter with speed, but he was one of those players that I feel like every time I saw him in person, he really performed. And so like my personal view of him was always much more impressive than the actual numbers that he showed when he looked up at the end of the day. But he got on base a little bit. He stole some bases. I think it's pretty good defense in the outfield. It's just a really light bat, and I'm curious to see how that bat plays in pro ball. Just seeing what he's done so far, 281, 412, 303. Yeah, I just don't think he's going to have much extra base ability at all. He really didn't show a lot in college. Only a few home runs in his total college career, but he's a very fun player to watch, I'll say.
Yeah, he is very fun. He plays the game really, really hard. Like you said, it is a slash and dash approach. There's little to no impact there, especially with Wood. He's a plus runner. He's strong defensively. I just think that long term he's going to end up in left field, which I think
Yeah,
is a little
compounded with
bit
the
of a
power is scary. Yeah.
yeah, it's a little bit of a ding to the profile. So you're going to really have to bet on him hitting, which so and the approach. The approach has been above average so far. Hitting, I think you can just describe it as fine. He's hitting 282 with more walks than Ks, which I think is encouraging. He's been a weapon on the base pass, 19 for 22 in stolen bases in 24 games. Again, though, I just think he's going to have to really, really hit. So,
Yeah, and he is a player that's going to benefit from the new rules, like stolen bases being more of a factor. Maybe he can carve out a sort of backup role if he's this elite base runner, but there's at least more opportunities for a player of his type. But yeah, you're going to want to either see the approach be consistently above average, and otherwise, like improve the defensive grade and stick in center field. Like, there's just not a lot of margin for error, I would say, with a player like this. But again, it's a 14th rounder. He signed for 150,000, so I wouldn't say there's a ton of pressure on him to become a big league regular.
There's really no risk associated with the pick. It's only upside, so it's maybe a little unfair to rip apart the game that much. But yeah, it was an overall exciting class. There was a few arms that they took too later on that piqued my interest. Austin Amaral in the 16th and Merrick Baldo in the 17th, respectively. Two college performers. Amaral at Stetson, breaking ball is really impressive. Baldo at Loyola Marymount so far again. He's been throwing the ball really well in Fredericksburg. So I think that for the Nationals and the Mets, while the 2023 seasons were anything but impressive, I think that they each, especially the Nationals, can be pretty excited about what's coming down the road, even if it is 2 to 5 years. I think that they have an exciting crop of prospects.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that ties a really nice bow on our National League East draft reviews, Peter. So well done. Yeah, do you have a preference for any of these? It sounds like we're really big on Nationals and Mets. Do you think Braves, Phillies, or Marlins would compete with that? I think Mets, if
Oh
I had to
man,
pick
when all
one,
said.
because it's hard when you're it's hard comparing a team that picks two versus a team that picks 32, but man, the extra picks that the Mets got and a number of players that I'm just like personally high on, I'm a really big fan of their class, even though the Hurston Waldrop pick with the Braves still might be my favorite individual pick of this entire division.
Yeah, I like their class a lot, and you brought up a good point. When you pick so high, in the 1 through 5 range, you're gonna end up with a headliner that's gonna kind of carry your draft class, at least in these early conversations. But I'll go with the Nationals. I really like the college bats that they got. Maybe one of these senior signs pans out, and then a later round guy. I think that overall, I do like the Mets better, but I'll stick with the Nats.
Awesome. Well, I'll just go Mets in that case, and we can shake it up and give some love to the teams at the bottom of the division here. So, yeah, here's to a better 2024 and beyond for those clubs. But as we move forward, Peter, anything to plug or sign off with before we get out of here?
Yeah, as always, regardless of the level that you follow the most, Baseball America has you covered for whatever you want. And at least personally, what I'm working on, kind of rolling out these freshman spotlight pieces, going to hopefully have my second one up tomorrow. It'll be completed by tomorrow. Hopefully it'll go up then. We're going to go with a pitcher that I think is going to have a pretty high impact at his respective school, this spring.
Tell me it's
And we're
Cam.
going to
Tell me it's Cam.
It might be a lefty whose name rhymes with James Johnson.
Oh man. I'm excited for that one.
It's been fun diving deep on these guys. The plan is to do 2 a week and then kind of as fall practices and fall games start, see who's kind of sticking out.
Well, awesome. Thank you for that, Peter. Again, thank you for listening to the podcast. Thanks to all the BA subscribers out there that allow us to do what we do. You guys make it happen, so we really appreciate that. And then we'll see you next week for the National League Central. Two more of these for the kind of completion of our draft review series in the podcast, but that will not end the draft podcast. We'll be back weekly to talk about the draft in some capacity, whether that's reviewing other draft classes or looking ahead to 2024. So for Peter, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you next time.